today on the Pub Rat Lovecraft team tries to illuminate Lovecraft's texts, his mythos, and his philosophy. Dr. Robert M. Price, notorious Lovecraft scholar and perpetrator of the Cthulhu Prayer Breakfast, answers listener questions on Lovecraft, his colleagues, and his successors.
You guessed it, it's time for the Lovecraft Geek, and I'm your host, Henry Armitage. One self-promoting plug right at the outset. This isn't exactly Lovecraft-oriented, but I think some of you might like it. A book of mine just came out in paper. It has been available as an ebook, The Politically Correct Bible by Robert M. Price. And it's about $15. If you want an autographed copy, you can email me and let me know. But let's get on with our questions in the slime bucket, as I like to call it. J.R. Patton, writing from Kansas City, Missouri, and I had one quick question. Has anybody drawn a correlation between the worm creatures in The Challenge from Beyond and the worm-like creature in Haunter of the Dark? Both seem to have some sort of relationship to an artifact that activates when stared into. I know there is some deliberation about whether or not Blake was possessed by the Haunter in the end. If he was, that is only one more reason to think there could be some connection between that hideous thing and the thing that set up shop in the mind of the protagonist from The Challenge from Beyond and died in the woods. Any thoughts? I have looked back through The Haunter of the Dark. I'm not sure I see the reference you're thinking of. The Haunter itself, the Avatar of Darkness, is sort of pictured as a black cloud with wings and the famous three-lobed burning eye. Is he described in terms suggesting some sort of worm? I don't remember and didn't see that. This oracular seer stone motif does occur in both, but I would just think it's kind of another case of Lovecraft using the same general motif or device between different stories. I wrote an article years ago called Who is the Avatar of Darkness, in which I suggested that perhaps Lovecraft planned or even wrote the story with Sathagua, the creation of Clark Ashton Smith, in mind. That kind of fit more in my mind, especially given that The Haunter of the Dark is a sequel to Robert Bloch's The Shambler from the Stars, where the vaguely similar creature that devours HPL is explicitly Sathagua. And I suspect that's what Lovecraft had in mind, but he changed it. I mean, there's no textual evidence, no manuscript evidence for that as far as I know, but I would suggest that as a possibility. But if I am missing something, I'd like you, J.R., to let me know and point it out to me, and then if I didn't find it, but I could have missed it, so please help me out on that one. Okay. This is the many angled one. This is Lovecraft's narration of the history of the Old Ones in At the Mountains of Madness seems to parallel his view of the history of the American colonies. The Old Ones arrive on Earth from somewhere else and set up an ideal socialistic society. They build great cities. Over time, however, they slowly degenerate. They lose the ability to fly in space, and their arts and sciences suffer. They breed slaves, the Shoggoths, to do their work for them. There's a great war over the Shoggoths, and they are destroyed. They later recreate the Shoggoths, who destroy the Old Ones and haunt the ruins of the Old Ones' civilization, but have no culture of their own, merely aping those of their dead creators. This seems a lot like American history from HPL's point of view. The British colonize America, forming an ideal and enlightened society. They import slaves. The culture suffers. The Civil War. The second wave of Shoggoths, migrant workers from Europe and the Middle East, arrives. The non-British citizens integrate and begin to lose their own languages and cultures, becoming part of the melting pot. Things continue to deteriorate, in HPL's opinion, and so on, until the global empire of San Chan is established in the 50th century. Is this racist subtext really present in At the Mountains of Madness, or am I myself mad? I never thought of it that way, and it may well be that somebody else has, but it's new to me, and I'd have to hand the palm to you on that. That does make a lot of sense, because, I mean, it is obvious that much of the story is political allegory, even though Lovecraft once warned not to make interplanetary fiction any kind of political allegory, but he did, of course, here, and in The Shadow Out of Time. So he invites us to look for political allegory, and I somehow stupidly never thought of this, but you did. That makes an awful lot of sense, because this is also a good description of the very kind of thing he feared with the African ex-slaves. He didn't use that terminology, but I won't use the one he used. And especially with the immigrants from Southern Europe and elsewhere. And you can see that on sad display in the horrid red hook. He hated what he saw happening, which he interpreted the way you're saying. So that makes an awful lot of sense. I bet you're right. Sounds like a good article for Lovecraft Studies or some such. Or maybe the Lovecraft e-zine. I'm not sure if Lovecraft Studies is still around. If it isn't, what a shame. Signed, of course, your brother in Metraton Sabaoth. Now, here's one place I gotta mention a neurotic, pedantic feature of my insane thought. You are correctly quoting Lovecraft's spelling, Metraton, which comes up in the case of Charles Dexter Ward. But I'm faced with a crisis here, because in the annotated edition of Lovecraft that I worked on, I changed the spelling in the case of Charles Dexter Ward on this name because Lovecraft faithfully copied a mistranscription. And his source had it as Metraton, but in fact it's Metatron. And important archangel, the transfigured Enoch in Jewish mysticism, and I figured since it's just a mistake, there's no magic in leaving a mistake. So in the Arkham House it has Almanson Metatron. Well, there was no way to tell the difference between an N and a U in Lovecraft's handwriting, which is what they were working from. But in fact, he got it, I think, from Eliphas Levi E.A. Waite, possibly, and it should be Al-Musin, so in mine it reads Al-Musin Metatron. Boy, I got the same problem with Robert Bloch copying from a source that erroneously has Apollonius spelled with two P's instead of two L's, and I believe when I reprinted that story, I changed that. That's a problem. Should I stick with, what would ST do? Would he stick with the error unwittingly preserved by Lovecraft or Bloch, or would he go with what they would have written had they known it? Oh boy, what a mess! How many Shoggoths can dance on the head of a pin? Yeah. Okay, let's see, this is Art Turner from Rockford, Illinois. First of all, let me say briefly how much I'm enjoying the Lovecraft Geek, and that I hope you're able to continue producing it for a very long time. I think that won't be a problem, Art, because as long as Lovecraft readers have questions, and that'll probably never stop, and as long as I can just keep on gusting and there's really no danger of my running dry, whether any of it's cogent or not, you know, I'm not making any claims for that, but anyway, you had asked about your listeners' favorite mythos tales, both by the man himself and by other writers. I would say my favorite HPL mythos tale is The Shadow Over Innsmouth, with At the Mountains of Madness coming in a very close second. You can see that Frank Gorshin influence here. My favorite non-Lovecraft mythos tale is Arthur Machen's The White People, if it counts, and I should say indeed it does, and Charles Stross's A Colder War, which you alluded to in an earlier podcast. That is, if The White People doesn't count. Oh, what the heck, both of them, I say. My question is regarding two popular authors and their work. I'm wondering if you're familiar with the Lovecraftian tales of Stephen King, Jerusalem's Lot, Crouch End, and The Mist. I know you've praised the film version of The Mist. Curious if you've read the original novella. And what are your thoughts on them? I didn't care for Crouch End at all. I thought it was just on purpose, a kind of stream of consciousness, nightmarish, I don't even want to say progression, just a kind of a one damn thing after another, as I think Bierce put it. I didn't think it was very effective. If you didn't have Alhazred's Antiques on a store window sign, I don't think anybody would even say it had anything to do with Lovecraft. Didn't care much for that. But on the other hand, Jerusalem's Lot, I really enjoyed that very much. You might say, well, this is hardly vintage King. It's more his early, more generic stuff. I don't care. It's generic mythos stuff, and he did a great job of it. I liked it a lot. I wanted to include that and Graveyard Shift in my anthology. Which one was it? I guess the Exum Cycle, which hasn't come out yet, based on the Rats in the Walls, because these stories are inspired at least partly by it. I like it a lot, but of course I couldn't afford to get the permission to do that, understandably. Now, The Mist I did read many years before I saw the movie, and I thought both were terrific, and I'm afraid I have to say I like the movie even better, but it is remarkably faithful to the novella, and I think both of them are terrific. In fact, I've said for a long time that I think that this and brief story by Joe Pulver. I can't think of the darn title now. That was an excerpt from, a piece of a novel he was working on, one of the planned sequels to Nightmare's Disciple, which he decided not to do. Maybe we can mount a campaign to harass him into doing it. And Mark Rainey's story, can't believe I've forgotten this. I'm nearly 60. It's the beginning of the end here. Just call me the senile one. They have all written stories that are cameos, scenes of what happens in the world when the old ones take over. And all of them are really terrific. I know Robert Bloch did that briefly at the end of his novel Strange Eons, which I thoroughly enjoyed, but I found the end, the advent of Cthulhu and all that, confusing and just didn't understand what the heck was supposed to be going on there. But these three really did a great job. I was, once I had Pulver and Rainey over here, and we, a little too late in the evening, we put on The Mist, because I thought, well, you know, I don't have King here, but have these. I don't think the other two had seen this, and I thought, well, this is just perfect. I got three, the one in absentia, that these authors that have really done a great job, the post-mythos apocalypse, but nobody but me stayed awake. And not the fault of the mist, the fault of the lateness of the hour. Boy, was that fun, or would have been even more fun. Did you know the mist was... at least one of the people behind it was, what's-his-name, that does The Walking Dead. And, of course, there was at least one character from The Walking, two of them, that appear again in The Walking Dead in The Mist. Not that that improves The Mist. You don't really need to do that. But I liked the both versions of that very much. Also, as a, okay, back to the arts question. Also, as a comics fan, I trust you're familiar with the writer Alan Moore. Oh, you betcha. Have you read any of his Lovecraftian work, The Courtyard, The Neonomicon, etc.? No, I haven't. I'd like to, but I made some attempt to dig up some of that stuff, and I found that one of them was a comic book, really, which is no, obviously, not a mark against it, in my opinion, being a comics fanatic. One of them, I think it was supposed to be doing an adaptation of the fungi from Yuggoth, making stories out of the sonnets, even as Lovecraft himself did with a couple of them. Maybe that's what turned out to be a comic. I don't know, but I've never gotten a hold of them. I venerate Alan Moore for his great work on Miracle Man and The Watchmen, of course, just one of the greatest comics of all time. But I wind up not caring so much for some of his later stuff, like The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I believe it or not, I actually like the movie better. Alan Bloody Quatermain. I like that better. The... I only saw the movie there. I guess I read the first issue of the comic and wasn't that interested, but I liked V. I didn't quite understand why some things happened, but a terrific flick. Ew, the thing about Jack the From Hell, yeah, that was a very good movie. I never read whatever it was based on. And I really did not care for what he did with Supreme. Everybody seems to think he really revitalized that and so improved it. Well, Supreme had lost its way as a comic, and they didn't really know what to do with him. That was obvious. And so, yeah, I suppose what Moore did, trying to pick up the pieces and start over again, was better, but not better or as good as Supreme as he appeared in the first 20 issues or so before he was killed by the Rob Liefeld version of Doomsday, Crypt. I really, really enjoyed Supreme. I loved the idea, which I guess has been done by others since then and the numerous Superman clones. But the idea of what if Superman was as old as, what if he was actually as old as implied by the real starting date, right? That he's in his 20s or something in 1938, and he's been in space for decades and comes back grizzled, white-haired, but still superhuman powers and so on. And the guy, suppose the guy has an ego the size of his power. I thought that was great. I loved it, and Moore, in my opinion, made it into a kind of a gentle, pointless parody of the Silver Age Superman. I just never... and I so rejoiced when, a few years back, they revived the original Supreme. Eric Larson did, and I don't think they've carried through with that either, but oh boy, did I love that. Anyway, so I venerate Alan Moore, and once I heard part of an interview with him on Eric Davis's show. Carol, what's the name of that show? Eric Davis's radio show?
Expanded Mind.
Expanded Mind. I had to ask the brains of the outfit, my wife Carol. Heard an interview with him, which I thought was amazingly dull. I just thought, this is Alan Moore. Maybe it just caught him on a bad day, but I love Moore. I love some of his work. I just can't get over Watchmen, even after all these years. By the way, Eric Davis has an interesting essay on Lovecraft in his collection Nomad Codes. You might want to take a look at. I may be on his show in the near future talking about HPL and other things. We'll wait and see. Thanks, Art. Okay, Ankh, that is Anne K. Schwader, a terrific Lovecraftian poet and author. She is just great. You ought to look into some of her books, all of her books. She says, my favorite Lovecraft collaboration, quote-unquote, story is The Mound, though I know now that Zelia Bishop didn't write all that much of it. Seeing a female byline on a Western mythos story was very important to me when I was discovering Lovecraft, because she's out in the West. Right? Could you discuss how Lovecraft came to ghostwrite this one and how much Bishop contributed to it? Well, he did make a few bucks, and I don't think that's even minimizing metaphor, not many bucks, doing his revision work, as he called it, and as you say, that supposed silent collaborations, but really it was ghostwriting. Zelia Bishop sent him ideas, at least for the three that were published, Winged Death, Out of the Eons, and The Mound. But that was all she sent, was just the teensiest little efforts toward a premise. And in the case of The Mound, she all she sent was, there's a haunted mound out in the West. Sometimes a ghost is seen on it. I'm probably not getting it word for word, but that's it. It was no longer than that, no more explicit than that. She had no idea of this underground civilization of Kanyan. I mean, Lovecraft got the idea of that out of Robert W. Chambers and so on. She had almost nothing to do with this. Now, there was also a rumor going around for a while that Frank Belknap Long was a contributor to this story. That wasn't the case. S.T. Joshi pointed out once that if anybody was a real collaborator, it was August Derleth, and in the worst sense that he abridged it for publication. I don't know. And, of course, it's published in its original form these days. But Bishop had this limited imagination in that she had... wait a minute. I'm getting her mixed up here with another one. But she, the West element that Anne points out, she's also the one that made a minimal suggestion that wound up being the curse of Yig. Now, it'd be easy to read this and to infer that this was a genuine collaboration, because it reads much more like a kind of fake true tale of weirdness, or almost a ghost story, much more conventional than we would usually expect from Lovecraft. But in fact, he did write every bit of it. She just suggested something about a snake curse, and that was that. I've got more about these stories in my upcoming Chaosium collection, The Yig Cycle. So I hope you get to read that pretty soon. And I hope everybody else gets to read Anne's stuff. It is really amazing. She's terrific. I would say she shares the crown of being the most genuinely Lovecraft sonneteer, if there's such a word, with Richard Tierney. You read either one of these and you would swear you're reading more Bits of the Fungi from Yuggoth. Both of them are just great. Tolan writes, greetings, oh great Geek Thulu. Before I start, I should mention my favorite HPL story is a toss-up between The Color Out of Space and The Shadow Over Innsmouth, the former for its dark and disturbing outlook, and the latter for its unexpected and unprecedented action scenes. Anyway, here's a couple for the old slime barrel. That's what I called it to begin with. I called it the slime bucket. By the way, how come there was such action in The Shadow Over Innsmouth? Well, I guess there's no way to prove this, but I suspect Will Murray was right, as he almost always is. when he said, and you can't underestimate this guy and his surmises about the past, given Will's psychic powers, an amazing man. Anyhow, he suggested that based on passages in Lovecraft's letters where he complained that the Clayton magazines, and I guess specifically Strange Tales, it was all action-oriented, and he was going to try to write something that might satisfy that, because as you know well, as you say, he didn't usually write action scenes or anything else on purpose, right? He was just trying to create a mood and all that, but Will suggests that maybe he had these action sequences in The Shadow Over Innsmouth because he hoped to sell it to the editor there. I wouldn't be surprised. Anyway, yeah, I love those stories too. But which ones don't I love? I guess the moon bug is not a particular favorite, but what the heck. Let's see. Here's a couple of questions. In a recent episode, you mentioned an idea created for a Star Trek novel that intersected with the old ones. Yeah, Mark Saraceni came up with the idea where Kang, the Klingon counterpart to Kirk, how's that for alliteration, was going to somehow open the portal or stumble through it to contact the old ones, but the series... the book series editors didn't go for it for some reason. It would have been great, especially with Mark Saraceni writing it. Okay, I was wondering if you knew of any completed sci-fi, Lovecraftian crossover stories. Well, you know, Babylon 5 eventually trespassed pretty far into the Lovecraftian framework with the first ones and the Shadow War and all of that stuff. That was almost explicitly Lovecraftian. There was also a few tips of the space helmet to Tolkien, strangely enough, but the Lovecraft was pretty pronounced in there. Here's a couple of anthologies I think you would get a kick out of. Edited, I think the editor is D.J. Butler. Perhaps he is one of the contributors, but I'm pretty sure he's the editor. The first called Space Eldritch, and the second, what a surprise, Space Eldritch 2, The Haunted Stars. And these are well-regarded stories of science fiction, even including space opera, my favorite kind of science fiction, crossed with Lovecraft. I think you ought to take a look at those. They're both available on Amazon. It shouldn't be tough to find them. I think you'll really get a kick out of that. He goes on, personally, I find the idea of a humanity with Star Trek-style starships and advanced science interacting with some sort of great old one to be fascinating and would love to see it fully fleshed out. Also, I recently stumbled upon an anthology of Lovecraft comic stories online. As I impatiently wait for my order to come in, I was wondering if the geek had any familiarity with Lovecraft comics, and if there were any favorites you could share. Well, this is a burgeoning field, expanding like Wilbur Whately and his brother. I have long since stopped trying to stay on top of this. When I say what I'm about to say, I am not making a comment on the ones I'm not mentioning because there's just too many of them. I don't have the time or money to read. I'm glad that this explosion has occurred, but I just can't stay up with everything. But I thought Breccia's Dunwich Horror and this whole book of Lovecraft stories he did, I thought that was really terrific. Just beautifully done, and I would recommend that to everybody. Breccia, I'm not quite sure, correct me if I'm wrong there, but I love that, and of course there are other terrific things out there too. I just I'm not familiar with many. Let's see. Oh, like I think Roy Thomas wrote a Haunter of the Dark adaptation that was pretty good back in, oh boy, what was that called? Chamber of Chills or something like that. He did some good Howard horror story adaptations too. You know, Roy is putting together beautiful reprint collections of Phantom Lady, Planet Comics, The Heap, stuff I never thought I would get to read, and good old Rascally Roy, a Lovecraft fan, as you might guess, he's doing us a great service there. I read the first collection of, the first volume of Planet Stories. I could not believe how crude and rotten the stories were, but I'm told they quickly build up to really fascinating stuff with beautiful artwork. I know Lynn Carter was a great fan of Planet Comics. In fact, he even sort of borrowed one of their characters, Star Pirate, and started writing stories about him. Why let a good character go to waste? Then continuing, on the show you often mention various Lovecraft movie adaptations. First, I was wondering if you're familiar with the great adaptations of Call of Cthulhu and The Whisperer in Darkness by the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. I personally consider them to be a must-see. Or musty. I have seen Call of Cthulhu a couple of times. I think it's great. It's really well done. Even though the emergence of Cthulhu himself looks a little hokey and obviously not real, that's probably better, right? Because you're supposed to get the idea that this could have been a film from the time of Lovecraft, and so you'd expect it to be stop motion and so on. I really thought it was great. I loved it. I'm ashamed to say, you know, I'm a bad Lovecraftian. I even have a copy of The Whisperer in Darkness, but have not yet gotten around to see it. That and a few million other things. I'll have to, though. I'm sure it's great, too. Okay, going on. I personally consider them to be a must-see. However, as I understand it, Lovecraft himself did not actually want people to make movies out of his work and was against any kind of adaptation being made, judging by the stories of his reactions to even the slightest editorial changes in his tales. It seems he was very protective of what he saw as the integrity of his work. What are your thoughts on the matter, especially considering the varying quality of some HPL adapted movies? I used to gripe at, as a, you know, true fanboy, I used to gripe at changes made to the stories, but even the handful once available, like the Dunwich Horror from 69 or 70, I've read both dates, and Die Monster Die and The Haunted Palace. Of course, Die Monster Die, I'm sure you know, is The Color Out of Space. And, well, I guess you want to count Blood Island, a.k.a. The Shuttered Room, based on the Lovecraft-Derleth posthumous collaboration. And the Curse of the Crimson Cult, based on loosely on the dreams in the Witch House. I got a kick out of them anyway. I mean, probably the furthest removed from the source material was The Shuttered Room. That's the farthest away, and yet in some ways I thought that, I mean, it is set in Dunwich, and Oliver Reed plays a kind of character that sort of suggests Wilbur Whately, and I thought in many ways it was a pretty strong adaptation, but it's a real adaptation. I mean, you might say it's just sort of inspired loosely by the original. Now, is that equally true of the Dunwich Horror, Die Monster Die, and the others? Well, they do stick closer to it, but to me now, it's more important that they make a decent, entertaining flick out of it. I don't really expect them to be able to make a movie out of stories that have very little action or character development, and that, again, on purpose. It's kind of an odd choice, so if they do it, you've got to expect it to be quite different, so that no longer bothers me. I like the Dean Stockwell Dunwich Horror on its own grounds. I just think, well, of course, they've redefined Wilbur as a kind of a Charlie Manson character, but he's pretty good at it. And Well, Lavinio's pretty good, as I remember. Armitage, too, and oh, the great Sam Jaffe as Wizard Whately. Someday you folks will hear Child of Lavinia's call in its father's name on Sentinel Hill, and then you will know. Oh, great stuff, great stuff. Boy, I'd kill to get the copy of that that staff he had. When is somebody out there going to make one? Come on now. Send me a free one for review. Anyhow, also, is it possible that there is not an action figure of Wilbur Whately? I mean, not necessarily the Stockwell character. I could do without that, but, you know, like the Lee Brown Coy cover or whatever. Come on now. Let's do some. I know a guy that works for NECA, N-E-C-A. I'll have to ask him if he could do it, exert my insidious influence. But I like that, and the color out of space. I mean, Die Monster Die with Boris Karloff. I think you, Letitia, are the superstitious one. Chains for devils. Oh, man. Yeah, I know it's a little hard to get past Nick Adams, but there's some good scenes even there. It's like a zoo in hell. I kind of like that movie. Is it very much like The Color Out of Space? Well, you can see the Lovecraft element in it, though. Let's put it this way. You know how Corbin Whently, or whatever Karloff's character's name was, took bits of the meteorite and put them in the bottom of the pots, the what the heck you call them for the plants, and that made them grow like crazy into monstrous forms. That's kind of what happened with the movie, right? Lovecraft's story is like that radioactive chunk that gives rise to this big, hulking, monstrous creature of the movie. But I could get a big kick out of it. Yeah, I know Arkham is now in England and so forth. But do you like that better, or do you like the Will Smith, Claude Aiken, The Curse, done in the early 80s? I don't care for that at all. I love Claude Aiken. Unlike some, I don't mind Will Wheaton. Will Wheaton, Wilbur Whately? I never even thought of that. But to me, the Karloff, Nick Adams version is infinitely superior, even though the other one is technically a bit closer. So is it now? The thing that really is a great example of this is In the Mouth of Madness with Sam Neill. Like, that isn't based on any Lovecraft story that I know of, yet it's very Lovecraftian in many ways. So I say, look, let's cut the umbilical cord. Let's just do something that is inspired by Lovecraft. How about Cthulhu, this, quote, amateur film based on The Shadow Over Innsmouth in modern times? I thought that was terrific. Not very Lovecraftian in some ways. Mood, atmosphere, no. But important elements are done very well in that. So, you know, if somebody can do a close adaptation like the Historical Society, that's great. But these other ones, what the heck? Let 100 radioactive flowers bloom, I say. So I'd kind of take the broad view. I will just say, you know, the comics, the movies and all that, there is such a plethora and a proliferation of all these, I haven't even mentioned the games and so on, of all these forms of Lovecraftiana that I admit I have the old turtle shell reflex sometime. There's so much of it. And way too much to follow that occasionally I figure, you know, let me take a vacation from this and just get back and read Lovecraft himself again. Of course, I can't quite do that because there are all these terrific Lovecraftian writers like Joe Pulver, Laird Barron, Cody Goodfellow, and so many other ones. And so I can't really stick with that resolve. But one of these days, I'm just going to sit up there in my vaults of Yo Vombus and reread all these great things. Doc Savage, Otis Adelbert, Klein, Tolkien, Lovecraft, Howard, Smith. In fact, I'm about to reread all of Smith, because I foolishly promised Scott Connors I would write an article for an anthology of criticism about Buddhism in Clark Ashton Smith. I've been thinking of doing that for decades, actually, so I'm going to hit the books, not that it's going to be any burden to do, right? I love Smith. And then see if there's enough to write the article. Of course, if there isn't, I guess I'll write the article saying, you know, what an abortive thought experiment this turned out to be. Let's see. Tolan asks, this is a long question, but I'm not complaining. Feel free to, you know, send in as many questions as you want. He says, I was also wondering about your opinion on Lovecraft's sense of humor in his stories. Specifically, I'm thinking of the story Sweet Ermengarde and Herbert West. Do you think Lovecraft could have done well as a comedy writer? And are there any other humorous Lovecraft stories you know of? Herbert West is humorous in the sense that it's over the top, though not nearly so much as the Jeffrey Combs movies. By the way, I interviewed Jeffrey Combs years ago in the pages of Scarlet Street. Very, very nice guy. That is really wild, and as you know, and does have overt humor in it. I don't really remember much real humor on the surface. With Lovecraft, there are ironies and snide comments, like the whole idea that the human race was made as a joke or a mistake and so on. That's a jaded, scathing comment on human nature, worthy of Richard Tierney. Some of it, like one good example of what I'm thinking of is in From Beyond. Ever see the Jeff Combs movie there? The Lovecraft basis for that movie is over by the time the opening credits begin. Mildly interesting anyhow. But in that one, as the omniscient Joshi has pointed out, the premise is kind of based on a philosophical satire that I've mentioned before. I won't beat it to death, but the philosopher René Descartes had painted himself into a corner, arguing that mind and matter are so different, one cannot influence the other. And then how the heck do we have the mind commanding the body what to do to get up off our butts and so forth? In the nature of the case, mind cannot influence matter, like we don't have telekinesis, like Jean Grey, right? Then how the heck can I move my own hand? That's the function of the pineal gland. Nobody really knew what it did or what it was at the time. Yeah, maybe that's the clearinghouse. Get out of here. You can't say that by nature the two types of substance can't interact and say, well, that's where they do it over there in that closet. Yeah, that's the ticket. Well, Lovecraft didn't think much of that, and rightly so. And so he has the pineal gland as the inner eye that if you could stimulate it, it would see all these invisible things, which is pretty neat. But that's a kind of a joke, but are you liable to know it? Did he expect anybody to catch that? And does it really affect the story? There's some other stuff like in Winged Death, that was one of Hazel Heald's stories, where you find out that the narrator, his mind has been transferred into a tsetse fly, and he's typing the long narrative in a tent in Africa as he as a fly, he's dive bombing one typewriter key after another. Now that's pretty funny, but I'm not sure if Lovecraft meant it to be. The end of the Diary of Alonzo Typer, which I love, which he co-wrote with William Lumley, no relation to Brian. And now that was a real collaboration. There's a draft that I published years ago in Ashes and Others, and Crypt of Cthulhu number 10. I guess that'll be in the first volume of the hardback facsimile edition of Crypt of Cthulhu that's going to make its debut this April at the Lovecraft Film Festival out in Portland. In that one, there is this actual draft by Lumley that ain't bad, but Lovecraft improves it. In that one, The guy is staying in a haunted house, and by the end of the thing, these black paws materialize in the air in front of him and grab him, and the last words of the story are, "Am being dragged towards cellar." What the hell? I tried to fix that in my sequel, The Strange Fate of Alonzo Typer, which you can find in my collection, Blasphemies and Revelations. Another self-serving plug, sorry. And, so the humor, I don't know, I kind of think of Robert E. Howard advising Lovecraft to write for the spicy pulps, which Howard did, but they're only mildly risque, kind of half-humorous adventure stories. I think this is because Howard was completely and utterly innocent of sex. Of course, Lovecraft comes pretty close to that, but he suggests that Lovecraft write for the spicy pulps, and of course, there's no chance Lovecraft would ever have done that, but I decided to find out one time what would it be like if he did, and so I wrote my little pseudepigraphical tale, I Wore the Brassiere of Doom by Sally Theobald, and of course this is supposed to be ghost-written, written under a pseudonym by Lovecraft for the Confession magazines, and it becomes pretty obvious, I think, toward the end that this is a joke, but I managed to do my job a little too well, because a few years later, a massive book on Lovecraft came out in France, and there was this exhaustive bibliography, and it listed as among Lovecraft's work, I Wore the Brassiere of Doom. Yeah, well, maybe they were kidding, but I don't think so. So I think of that, Lovecraft writing comedy. I'd love to see it, but I have a hunch I'd be cringing my way through it. Hey, Tolan says, finally, there's one thing that's occasionally bothered me in some of the original tales. In the story at the Mountains of Madness, it is revealed that the Elder Things created the Shoggoths as a slave race. It is also revealed the Elder Things had a great war with the Deep Ones eons ago. However, in the story The Shadow Over Innsmouth, the Deep Ones are said to have Shoggoths as well. I'm not very familiar with any of the Lovecraftian works beyond H.P.L. himself. Has there been any explanation attempted as to the change of ownership? Or is it just assumed that Shoggoths are now just a sort of muscle for hire, I think you got something there, available to any powerful enough to control them? They're made of earthly matter, after all. I suppose the various higher beings may view them as being similar to humans in terms of control and usefulness. Just drive them crazy and point them in the right direction. Does that seem right to you, or am I completely off base here? What sayest the geek? I think there's a little bit of a problem here in that it says that the star-headed old ones were at war with the Cthulhu spawn, but it doesn't say what they are. It might be that they're the Deep Ones, but it's hard to say, really. I mean, I think Father Dagon in The Shadow Over Innsmouth is supposed to be Cthulhu, and just using a sort of a biblical alias for him. So in that case, if he's the father of the cult, in a sense you could say that they're the spawn of Cthulhu, but that's not clear or explicit. I tend to assume the Cthulhu spawn are supposed to be octopus-headed creatures, but it sure doesn't describe them in At the Mountains of Madness. So it's not clear to me that the Deep Ones have anything to do with it, or that Lovecraft did for his whole cycle of stories what he did for individual ones, namely composing a detailed backstory and an overarching story that the bones of the skeleton, so that when he was actually writing the narrative, he didn't contradict himself. As I say, he did that for each story, but he doesn't seem to have done it for the stories as a whole, because he wasn't trying to write a continuous epic or something. He just revisited certain themes and characters and entities occasionally. That's why the Necronomicon is spoken of in totally contradictory ways from story to story. What did he care? I mean, it was just, what could he do with this prop in this story and that story? Nothing to criticize. Well, in the same way, he doesn't seem to be consistent. I did an article called Lovecraft's Cosmic History trying to point this out. For instance, in At the Mountains of Madness, it has, I believe, the outer ones from Yuggoth showing up after Rillier sinks, after the war with the Cthulhu spawn. But in The Whisperer in Darkness, the pseudo-Akeley tells Wilmarth that the outer ones were here before the sinking of Rillier. Well, he didn't keep it straight. I don't want to say he couldn't keep it straight. He just didn't bother. It sounded good, so that's the way he does it. So I don't know that a link like that is worth trying to forge. In fact, the fact that he has sea Shoggoths, is that the same thing? I mean, I guess it is. I mean, the, you know, Shoggoths, that is... now, is that a reference to the other story? Or has he just used the same thing twice? It would make sense either way, because, for instance, there are explicit references in The Shadow Out of Time to At the Mountains of Madness. We're to understand that both of these stories happened. That is, each is part of the narrative world of the other. But is The Shadow over Innsmouth part of the anticipated narrative world of At the Mountains of Madness, or vice versa? Yeah, probably so, but I guess he just liked the Shoggoths, and since they were still around, I mean, they're still there in the modern day at the end of At the Mountains of Madness, somehow they had made their way to warmer waters, and it just sort of leaves us hanging as to how they got where they did. Fascinating. Are the Elder Signs mentioned by Zadok Allen supposed to be the same thing as those geometric forms they found that turned out to be tracks of the star-headed old ones? Are they supposed to be the same thing? Because Zadok Allen says they're sort of like what you call swastikas. But then Lovecraft did a hand-drawn version of the Elder Sign in a letter, which looks like it's just a branch, like it's an Arbor Day graphic or something. So who knows what the heck's going on there. Let's see. By the way, you probably get a kick out of a story of mine that's in some upcoming anthology, the story being called Invaders from the Black Lagoon. It gets into all this Innsmouth Shoggoth stuff. Okay, now you, let's see. This is from Phil in the tenebrous, unlitten Black Hills of South Dakota. The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all the knowledge imparted by the Lovecraft geek. Why, thanks. First, did I hear you correctly when you stated on a recent Lovecraft geek that the protagonist of The Shadow Over Innsmouth was named Olmsted or Almstead? Yeah, in fact, it's Robert Olmsted with an O. Has it been remarked that this name reminds us of the Olm, O-L-M, the European cave-dwelling amphibian that retains gills all its life and is wholly aquatic? This from Wikipedia. The Olm, or Proteus, Proteus anguinus, is the only cave-dwelling chordate species found in Europe. In contrast to most amphibians, it is entirely aquatic, and it eats, sleeps, and breeds underwater. Living in caves found in the Dinaric Alps, I guess that's how you say it, it is endemic to the waters that flow underground through extensive limestone of karst, K-A-R-S-T, of central and southeastern Europe, specifically the southern Slovenia, the Soča, I don't know how to say that with a marking on it, a river basin near Trieste, Italy, southwest Croatia and Herzegovina. What a great Lovecraftian critter. Well, you know, I at first kind of think, well, would Lovecraft have known about this? But yeah, he might have, right? I mean, look at all the biology and zoology crammed into At the Mountains of Madness. He might well have known that. That's fascinating. Great stuff. Oh, by the way, for some reason, this reminds me of some confession of ignorance I made in the first episode some months ago, where I mentioned that someone had done an interesting presentation at the Necronomicon in Providence about the possibility that Lovecraft based some of his mythos on South American materials. Now, of course, we knew there was some connection there with the transition of Juan Romero and the Electric Executioner and so forth. I was trying to think of the name of the Aztec god he said Cthulhu might have been based on, and I was drawing a blank. Of course, it's Tlaloc, T-L-A-C-O-C. Who knows how you pronounce it, but Lovecraft wouldn't have known either. But you do have to wonder if that was possibly the inspiration for Cthulhu, which has a lot of the same letters. Interesting. Okay, sorry. Second one. This one is about Lovecraft correspondent Robert E. Howard, so hopefully you'll allow it under the Lovecraftian penumbras and emanations clause. Ah, yes, I worship Howard right alongside Lovecraft. Anyway, rereading Henrik Sienkiewicz's 1896 novel Quo Vadis, I noticed a familiar-sounding description of the inhumanly strong northern Lygian barbarian Ursus. To find anyone in Rome was not easy, even with the most accurate directions. But in those cases, the instinct of the hunter aided Ursus, and also his great knowledge of the city. Ursus is also described as having wrestled a wild bull, the aurochs, that's the so-called unicorn of the King James Version, in his early years, which brought to mind Conan's battle with a strangler in one of those stories, the strangler who began by strangling babies. That was Kermit Gosnell, wasn't it? Worked up through children and women until he could break the necks of grown men. Conan, or the narrator, then says that he strengthened his grip by climbing cliffs and wrestling the wild bulls of his native Sumeria, and then defeats the strangler sent to kill him. In Quo Vadis, Ursus also snaps the neck of the strongest wrestler in Rome who was sent to assassinate him, and then goes on to kill the aurochs, the wild bull in the arena. So do you think Ursus played any part in the formation of Conan? Don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Howard borrowed a lot of stuff from places one might not first expect, like Talbot Mundy was a major influence on him. Edgar Rice Burroughs was. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I remember being amazed when Sprague de Camp wrote something for Crypt years ago, showing how Wolves Beyond the Border, great Conan tale, owes a lot to American Indian stories set in New York State by Robert W. Chambers. Holy mackerel! So who knows? I wouldn't be surprised now that you mention it. I believe Avram Davidson wrote a book of stories about a barbarian hero called Ursus, which means the bear, right? And there were various Italian sword and sandal movies made about Ursus. Great name. So that, again, is from Phil. In the gorges and ravines of problematical depth that intersect the way in the Black Hills of South Dakota. Well, of course, we got to come to the bottom of the slime bucket sooner or later, and we just did. But I expect I will be receiving more great questions from all of you Lovecraftians out there, so think them up and send them in. It's been great shooting my mouth off. I would say interminably, but this is the termination for the moment. And take a look on Facebook for the teaser for the documentary being done on me, The Gospel According to Price, by fellow Lovecraftian Joseph Nani, N-A-N-N-I. Take a look at this. You'll find it kind of funny, and you'll be amazed at how I resemble the twin of Wilbur Whately once the powder of Ibn Ghazi was sprayed upon him. So I'll see you next time, soon again, on The Lovecraft Geek.
The Lovecraft Geek was recorded by Robert M. Price and produced by John Felix. Catch up with Mike Davis and Mythos communities everywhere by devouring the free online Lovecraft e-zine at lovecraftzine.com for events, news, and information. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Lovecraft Geek on iTunes. To catch up with Dr. Price's projects, purchase merchandise, and donate to help support Dr. Price and his family, please visit robertmprice.mindvendor.com. Thanks for listening to The Lovecraft Geek. I'm Torrin Atkinson.